Great. Jerry Sussman, thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I really did enjoy your recent article about cultural divisions in the U.S. And what kind of cultural divisions are we talking about? Normally, I think a lot of us think that it's education and income that lead to the cultural divisions. Are there other parts of this?
Well, I mean, what I argued in this article, In Common Dreams, is that both parties, both political parties, and the general discourse in America is about cultural differences. And both parties actually benefit from playing this up. This is a strategy. So what we're talking about is, you know, the conservatives will talk about issues that interest their voters, or they think they do, issues like abortion, issues about identity politics, issues about religion, these sorts of things. And the Democrats and the liberals, on the other hand, you know, play up the very same issues about inequality and you know, representation of blacks and minorities and women in public institutions and private institutions. And this is what the agenda is. You know, I think really this was really captured most directly when Hillary Clinton ran for president in 2016. And she talked about, she made it really stark contrast when she used that unfortunate expression, the basket of deplorables, you know, which was widely interpreted as an attack on well, especially the white working class that was turned toward the Donald Trump, right? So, you know, this brought it out in stark relief, sort of the cultural approach. And, you know, what I argued in the article was that, you know, while, you know, these cultural divide does exist on the, you know, basis of representation, the larger question, I think, that really divides, that really polarizes people, is distribution, is the question of distribution. This is an expression that came from Nancy Fraser, a political economist, who talks about recognition versus distribution. So while recognition has been an important struggle, often, you know, the emphasis on recognition ignores the issue of distribution. In other words, the benefits that are being denied to the working class in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the general argument that I'm making. And then I provide a lot of data, you know, to back up exactly how bad the issue of real polarization, of the real polarization in terms of the distribution of benefits to America, to especially working class Americans, which has really declined over the years under neoliberalism.
And I haven't seen a list like that before. I thought that was a very successful list. I mean, you found so many examples of how people who have money and the wherewithal are essentially running essentially both parties, I would think. So that list, that must be 25 things on that list. That was,
well, on my that's just a short list that I put in the article. If I drew attention to the book on which it's based. It's called, the book was called British and American, British and American, it's a long title, British and American Electoral Politics in the Age of Neoliberalism. And in the book, I have far more extensive data. I think it's overwhelming data that shows that democracy has been hollowed out over the years under neoliberalism, which I assume the audience knows what that means. But, you know, generally the emphasis on the free market and austerity spending and, you know, reducing government in welfare programs and the like, and giving free rein to corporations to expand, merge, and go abroad and exploit even more than they exploit American workers exploit third world workers. And in fact, I think that's something that's really missing from the general discourse, even on the left. in America is the recognition of third world labor. There's very, very little attention given to that. And third world labor is really part and parcel of first world labor. You know, you know the expression first world, third world. You could say the global South and the West. You know, they're really part of the same labor force, but doing, but it's broken down into a division of labor, whereas the manual tasks have been shifted more to the third world. But anyway, I mean, this is what has been going on, and Americans and other and Western Europeans as well, especially the British, who I focused on in the book, as along with Americans, have suffered the most under neoliberalism. And precisely because it was the United States and Britain that most avidly adopted neoliberalism as a platform, starting with the era of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher up to the present.
When's the last time the our population, the U.S. Citizenry, really thought their leaders could do anything for them, or I mean, wanted to or could?
Yeah.
I wonder if part of the problem is you have to really go back in U.S. history to the 1930s before you had this feeling that they were looking around for how to make people's lives better. I can't think of, I mean, people have acknowledged that, but, you know, they really haven't worked for it. So I wonder if we've just forgotten that that's part of what our contract with the with our government really is. We want, you know, benefits, and we want them working to make our lives better. But there hasn't been a person, the president since FDR, that really has talked about doing that, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, it's often said that FDR, really, he saved capitalism. He saved capitalism from itself.
Right.
And he, you know, he organized what became known as the New Deal, which continued, you know, all the way through the Lyndon Johnson and even the Nixon presidency. You know, Nixon is, believe it or not, Nixon is often referred to as the last liberal because a lot of liberal programs were initiated under his presidency, including, you know, the EPA and public broadcasting and all sorts of progressive.
Yeah, he came out for that. He famously, well, maybe it just stuck with me because it was so terrible. He tried to devise additions to the Clean Water Act so it would be vetoed, you know, that it would, wouldn't pass. I mean, he was desperate, you know, not to pass the, what he said he was going to pass, you know, which is...
Well, the difference back then compared to now is the political orientation of both parties. I mean, the Democratic Party was definitely very liberal, even left of liberal. And even the Republicans, were many liberals in the Republican Party at the time. Mm. And they formed, they got together and actually impeached Nixon. You know, it took the support of the liberals in the Republican Party to make that happen. But ever since then, it was really... you know, during the period of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, that they went full blast into new neoliberalism. And up to that point, I would say, you asked, you know, at what point was it ever better? I would say that the, if we go back to the 1970s, you know, kind of gliding off the post-war, you know, a situation in the United States where the U.S. dominated overwhelmingly the production of goods and services for the whole world, you know, 50% or 60% of television, automobile, you know, all the major industrial products were largely dominated by the United States. So this created a false, kind of a false understanding in the United States, and particularly among workers, you know, that this was going to go on, you know. Right. And meanwhile, you know, in the 50s, the left representation in unions, you know, the influence of communists and socialists in the unions completely, you know, as you know, was completely purged. So all the progressives who might have warned the unions about, you know, not taking this for granted, this is going to move in a dark direction, were not listened to. Mm. And anyway, So that's, you know, that's what really radically changed. American wages reached a peak in the 1970s, and it's been pretty downhill ever since.
The problem of profitability, I think Europe had that problem as well, and may have started the neoliberal era where everything is cut to the bone so that the very rich can have more money. Do you think
we've seen enormous concentrations of wealth, polarization
amazing.
Of wealth. Yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah. This goes back to my main point, is that the question of polarization, which has been hyped by the Democrats and the Republicans to focus more on, you know, social relations among people, it's really been exaggerated. And it, on the other hand, it has ignored what the real polarization is, which is the polarization of, you know, capital on the one hand, which has become very wealthy and very concentrated, and the growing disenfranchise of the American working class, which represents the overwhelming majority of the American people. That's the central point. It's really about the discourse and the propaganda, and the ways in which both political parties are using identity politics in different ways. And as a way of defocusing on the real conditions of American workers, what would matter, and what this leads to, you know, what this leads to is, as conditions get worse, public confidence in public institutions has radically declined. So at the moment, about 9% of the American public has any confidence in the American Congress, that American Congress is anything but a group of people who take bribes from corporations and is totally linked to the corporate sector. That's what only 9% of American people have any confidence in the Congress. And it's very low. It's about 25% for the presidency, you know, in the low 20s for the Supreme Court. So as conditions got worse, public confidence got worse. And as public confidence gets worse, we have very low voting rates, so voting participation rates in both. And in my book, I compared Britain and Britain and the United States, because both countries, as I said, both most avidly adopted neoliberalism, and those are the two countries which have suffered in terms of political participation of citizens.
So, is it dangerous to be in a position where 3/4 of the population thinks that the present government is pretty worthless when it comes to supporting what they care about? Are we coming into an age where we would follow a demagogue? Of course, I'm talking about Trump.
In fact, that's what we did. That's what happened.
Right.
Trump actually captured a large majority of working class voters, both in 2016 and in 2024 and 2020 as well, that the Democrats had sort of turned away from the unions and the working class. This was an explicit policy initiated by Bill Clinton, which he called he referred to Democrats as the new Democrats. And he said, we're going to end welfare as we know it. Yeah. 3 strikes and you're out. And he was a strong advocate of neoliberalism and allowed, you know, a deregulation of corporate power, which led to massive mergers and acquisitions. And
look at journalism and the media. I mean, there's so many examples of that.
The strongest section of the working class in America was the industrial working class. That's where the best jobs, the best paying jobs were. And that all flew, you know, just flew out of the country to Mexico, to China, to Southeast Asia, to Bangladesh. And American wages have suffered ever since.
Yeah, so, never really came back.
Never recovered. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So are the no King's marches, are they making the same mistake? Or is that a slightly different, we're looking at a different animal than the faux progressives that we've listened to before?
Yeah.
Where does this fit into the scheme of things, the No Kings, the largest march in history?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I'm not sure if the analysis is really in about, one hand, as you said, it's the largest demonstrations in history. And it probably is a precursor to some radical changes that are on the way. On the other hand, I'm old enough that I remember the Vietnam War. And, during the Vietnam War, one thing I've known, I participated in the Three Kings marches myself, but one real difference was that during the Vietnam War, most people were marching in protest under banners that said, doctors against the Vietnam War, lawyers against the Vietnam War, educators against the Vietnam War. In other words, they were very, it was a very concentrated focus about getting out of Vietnam. Whereas, today, when I got these demonstrations and where I live in Portland, everybody's carrying a sign. Each individual, it's been kind of individualized, rather than the people marching behind banners and organization of different strata in society, lawyers, doctors, workers. Now it's all about individuals carrying signs. And also the Democratic Party plays a very strong role in organizing and speaking to the march. And, in my view, I have a more radical view, I think the Democratic Party is part of the problem. As I said in my article, the only thing worse than having a billionaire class run by, people from the real estate sector is having another billionaire party, which doesn't offer a major alternative.
Right.
Because,
right.
In the latter case, what you're doing is you're killing hope. And it's one thing, I think people on the left understand very well what the conservatives and the reactionaries in the Republican Party are all about. They understand that very well. But what's even worse is not having a party that represents, the interests of working people in America. And not having an alternative, because not having an alternative kills hope. And when you kill hope, people turn to very dangerous directions, as they did in Germany in the 1930s, when hope was killed because of, in that case, because of the Great Depression.
Mm. So you're really talking about, in some sense, vulnerability, that the two major parties, since it seems to be supported by the billionaires, there may be come a time when nobody supports the two parties and we cease to have a two-party system, or maybe we cease to have a democracy. I think it's a dangerous time. I wanted to ask you a question about one part of that. You referred to a propaganda mission of creating legitimacy for the hegemonic state. Is the empire part of the problem? I mean, we spend half our money, the government's money, on fighting wars, and we're, fighting, I don't know how many wars we're having right now, or maybe four or five, and then a possible attack on Iran. So is this part of the failure to give the American people what they deserve?
No, of course. I mean, all this money is spent on wars and boosting the stock portfolios of people who are invested in the military-industrial complex is money that's not going to, housing people, to educating people, to feeding people. Of course, this is a major obstacle to progress. But the way things are going, we don't know for sure, but the way things are going in Iran, this could be a real turning point. And, unfortunately, the unruthless suffering that the United States and Israel are imposing on that country is really despicable. But, out of this, some phoenix may arise, that brings a change. I don't know if it's going to come from a third party. I mean, people have often hoped for that, that there would be a very progressive party. But it's quite possible that the Democratic Party could give way from the old guard to a new guard of real progressive people like Mondani. My hope is that a guy like Mondani might, in a couple of years after being mayor for a couple of years, might be primed to make a stand at the national level. And he would be like a left-wing version of Obama, you know, a person of color, but with progressive orientation and a nice guy. You know, he has a nice reputation as a human being. He could do it. That's my hope. I don't see too many others, you know, on the horizon who are ready to take over the leadership. I think it, at least at this point, and maybe it's a lack of imagination on my part, but I can't see anything outside of the party structure, the way the United States is governed, the bias of the Electoral College, and the way we elect presidents. It's so incredibly corrupt right now. Revolving door, you know, of American members of Congress who by themselves are mostly multimillionaires. I mean, 2/3 of the Senate are millionaires.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah,
and more than half the House.
Yeah,
and even those numbers don't capture the people who are on the strategic committees. I mean, I think the percentages of millionaires. Of people on strategic committees like Armed Services Committee, the Budget Committee, and so on. It's probably close to 100%. And these are the people serving on these committees who then they then retire and get much more lucrative jobs in the sectors, the industrial sectors, the pharmaceutical sectors, the military sectors that they were regulating when they were in Congress. So, I mean, this is the level of corruption in America that the whole system is brought out.
Completely corrupt, and I think so many people realize it. And
they do. They do.
And when you ask them, I think this is in your article. You know, many more people believe they don't think we have a democracy.
I think it is
sort of questionable whether we do. For a lot of criteria, you know, we don't live in a democracy. Kleptocracy. You know, that's what we live in, not a democracy. And it's dangerous times, I think, and you know, maybe dangerous to the people. How many billionaires there in the U.S.? There's like 800 billionaires.
Yeah.
And then 60% of the country, you know, can't go from paycheck to paycheck. So you have this incredible sense of smoldering anger to that, and you don't know exactly where it's going to go, but
the thing you brought up, I just realized you brought up something a little bit earlier about the propaganda. So, you know, I wanted to just speak a little bit to that point, is that you know, all countries as part of the governance structure have to see to the protecting their legitimacy, right? There's an old nursery rhyme, right, that I sometimes would use in my classes. The nursery rhyme is Humpty Dumpty. You know, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And what that means, in my interpretation at least, is that when the king or the head of state, whoever it may be, loses his or her legitimacy, all the king's horses, which means all his military apparatus, police apparatus, and all the king's men, referring to like his cabinet, his propagandists, they can't put him together again. In other words, once you lose your legitimacy, the game is over. You know, you can't put it together. And that's what's happening. That's what's happened in America. It's that the system has lost its legitimacy.
Yeah.
And there's no going back. Unless something, you know, marvelous, a rise of people who come up who provide a real alternative.
Right.
And maybe once they get in power, they can, you know, tweak the Constitution a little bit to get rid of the Electoral College, which has this grip on the system.
Yeah.
So, but the propaganda is very, very important in terms of maintaining legitimacy. This is where the mass media is. plays a major role in supporting the propaganda of legitimacy of the system, which is why they don't pay attention to a lot of things going on in the country and internationally. They focus on logistics, and they don't focus on the cruelties that are happening in the war in Iran and in Gaza. They don't pay attention to that because their role is to provide legitimacy to the state, to the U.S. state, which is heavily involved in both situations and many other situations like that.
Yeah.
And
I think that education is, running this radio program, I like to get people educated so that they are aware of what's making them angry and maybe focus their anger. I mean, to change the system, it's an incredibly complex and strong system, but to change it, we have to educate the public. You know, they're angry what they should be angry against, you know, but...
Well, fortunately, we have programs like yours and many other social media programs that I pay, and many, many people pay attention to, that does provide alternative ways of seeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not, like, when I was growing up as a kid, there were just three television networks and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
That's what it was, yep.
Completely dominated what we what we saw, what we heard. You know, at the time, you know, I remember there was this great study by Carl Bernstein on the fact that the mass media, television and newspapers and magazines were working for the CIA from the creation of the CIA in 1947 all the way up to the mid 70s until it was exposed. Carl Bernstein exposed the fact that the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC, CBS, and all the rest were working hand in glove with the CIA at the time, and nobody knew it until it became exposed
and they were paying part of their salaries too. I thought that was a great point. I mean, they really were working for the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Well, Gerald, I want to thank you so much for doing the article, for standing out and saying things that you're not supposed to say in a society. You're either Republican or Democrat, and if you're a Green, even a Green, right? Ralph Nader is responsible. But so I think it takes some courage to stand out and write the things that you do write, and thank you for doing them. So and thanks
for being
an activist leader today.
Thanks for having me on your program. I appreciate that too. Take care.
You too. Bye now.